about Jahazi in general. So Jahazi is a journal of art, culture, and performance. And it was the brainchild of the late Bantu Mwaura, who I'm sure very many of our listeners may be familiar with. He was the founding editor and the editor-in-chief. And he was actually, he used to self-identify as an intellectual artivist, an activist for art. And so what we do is we try to embody his dream, and his dream was to create this platform for artists, theorists, cultural thinkers, scholars, and everyone in general, just to share knowledge and experience, specifically in the arts, in culture, and performance. Since he passed, we've come a long way. We have an advisory board and an editorial board at Jahazi. The advisory board has Professor Mwenda Ntarangwi, who is the CEO of CUE, which is the Council of University Education. We have Dr. Gannett Olunya, who is affiliated with the Gordon Arts Center. And then we also have Dr. Kahithe Kiru, who is affiliated with the Bomas of Kenya. And she's also an anthropologist and a scholar. And then we have the editorial board. So the editorial board has the publisher, and the publisher of Jahazi is Twaweza Communications, and which is headed by Professor Kemani Wanjogu. And then it has Mweni Lundi, who is a performance artist and a scholar. Faith Onea, who is a writer and a journalist with the National Media Group, and myself. So this is how it runs. And we sort of have these conversations between the advisory and the editorial board. We sit and then we ask ourselves, what are some of the issues that we need to address? So the last immediate issue was on the pandemic. We actually called it art in the time of the pandemic. Things were happening within the arts and culture scene now that the pandemic had shut everything down. And so for this particular one, we're looking at repatriation of cultural artifacts that have been stolen and continue to be stolen from specifically from African countries. We know that the thefts have taken place all over the so-called third world, you know, from people who have been occupied by occupying forces and colonizing forces. But for this specific issue, we were focusing on objects that have been stolen from the African continent and continue to be stolen.
Okay, there's a cultural restitution space. I mean, these are conversations we're having across. These things have happened over 500 years, you know, across different cultures and all these things and private collections out there, mostly in the global north, you know, a lot of it not accounted for, you know, you get snippets of ideas of where some of these things would be. Some of them brazenly displayed, you know, at some of these global museums. But then, so as a team, at what point did your team at Jahazi decide this is the time for this conversation? And when is the launch date?
Myself, my name is Caroline Mose. I am a lecturer at the Technical University of Kenya, and I am a trained cultural studies scholar. And so that is what I bring to Jahazi. Apart from that, I'm also a published and aspiring author. And so writing is a huge part of my life as well. So that's myself in a very small nutshell. To answer your question, at what point did we decide? I think these conversations happen very organically. I would want to peg it a little bit in part on the fact that we are becoming more aware as Africans, with especially after the death of George Floyd, who was actually killed on camera by a policeman. And then we had this movement, you know, Black Lives Matter, and it's a movement that spread all over the world. We had students in the UK in Bristol, in Liverpool, pulling down all these, I think that they were sculptures of very, I would say, problematic figures from the colonial era, the slave trade era, etc. And I think that movement in itself has moved the conversations on repatriation forward, because during that time, we had a lot of reporting as well, you know, in The Guardian and in many, and I think even the New York Times, where in the midst of this conversation about George Floyd and Black Lives, the conversation on repatriation became alive, was given new life in that sense. And we had actually, I think, a university in the UK returning a cultural object to Nigeria during that period. And I think that is the ways in which these things form organically based on global events. And I think that is how we ended up landing on, we really need to do something on repatriation. We decided not to go the traditional route of having only and mainly academics talk about this, because I have felt, I would imagine many other people have felt, that this is a conversation that has been confined within academia and academic spaces. We wanted to open this up so that the people from the communities, the people who are journalists, people who are on the ground, would be the ones to spearhead this conversation. So that's what we have done with this issue.
Okay.
The issue is tomorrow. At the Alliance Française on the third floor. The event is to start at 2:30 and end at around 5. We are going to have a panel, which I will be chairing, with three prominent, let me call them personalities within the spaces of repatriation. We're going to have somebody from HIVA Fund. We're going to have somebody from the National Museums, and then we're going to have somebody from the university as well, an art historian, just to take us through some of these key issues within the conversations on repatriation.
Okay, this is a 500-year problem, across hundreds, if not thousands of cultures, in the global South. Through narratives and anecdotes, what would you say are the glimpses into some of the things that we have lost? What did people really lose?
Right. You're right, because this has been ongoing for as long as we have been in existence. I would say this probably in the hundreds of thousands, maybe even I would venture to, hundreds of thousands of objects, like the tangible objects, have been lost. And I would also want to use the term not just lost, because the loss is on our side, but it was a deliberate theft, daylight robbery. These things were taken. So what has been lost? In the issue, we have three sections. The first section, we have said, bring back our people. And I want to start with that. By people, we're talking about people who were taken from our countries. And also to imagine that back in the day, the nation states as we know them did not necessarily exist as we have them today. But a lot of our people were taken. Some of our people were taken and placed in human zoos and freak shows in many European cities. We had freak shows and human zoos in France. We had them in the United Kingdom. We had them in Germany, where our people would be taken and displayed and their photographs were taken. So once they died, some of them were dissected, like the infamous story of Sarah Batman, but her real name was Satya Batman. She was actually taken and displayed in a human zoo. And when she died, her body was actually dissected. Her brain was placed in a jar. Her body parts were placed in jars. And a so-called scientific study was being conducted on her body. Very racist form of saying that the African brain looks smaller because Africans are generally not intelligent. That kind of thing and narrative. And I think her remains were repatriated back to South Africa, I think in 2001. Mm-hmm. Was taken in the 1800s. So when we say bring back our people, these are some of the things we're talking about. We had people taken. In this issue, we have the story of a Chaga chief who was called Mangi Meli. He was hanged. He had this rebellion going because he dared to have this uprising against the Germans. He was hung. His head was decapitated from the rest of his body. And the skull is in display somewhere in a museum in Germany, which in itself is extremely problematic because, and actually his grandson is the one who was actually interviewed for this particular article. And the title of the article, if I remember correctly, is, "What are you doing with my grandfather's skull?" Like, why would you have someone's skull sitting in a museum? What are you saying about this skull? Why did you separate the skull from the rest of his body? Because we know that in our cultures, you have to bury someone when they're whole. So when we say our people were taken, their remains were taken, their skulls were taken, their bones were taken. And what that then meant was that there was a disconnect. There was, you know, the cultural continuity, because these patriarchs and these matriarchs within our societies were the people who embodied culture and handed it over to the next generation. So when you have that colonial break, you have these people taken, it meant a disruption to the way of life. It meant a disruption to handing over from one generation to the next. So when we say our people, we're talking about the entire spectrum. And then we have what we are calling bring back our stuff, our objects, you know, our material objects. For the objects, it's the tangible objects, you know, the bronzes, the clothes. For instance, I had no idea that there was a seat of Emperor Theodros of Ethiopia in a city that was called Makla. And when it was raided, all the objects of royalty, including the queen's clothing, was taken and is now being displayed in either the British Museum or a museum in France. So our objects means that when these objects are taken, because these were not just objects that belonged, they belong to the community, but they also belong to individuals. It means that, and these stories carried within themselves, I mean, these objects carried within themselves stories and histories. And part of what has been stolen in a huge way has been our stories. I would venture to say that in the same way African Americans were disconnected from themselves in the period of enslavement, is the same way we've been disconnected with ourselves. And it's very dangerous when we as a people don't know who we are, because any narrative can be formed and given to us and we become convinced that that's who we are. If you think of an object like a knife, that was stolen from the Bunyoro Kingdom and taken to the United Kingdom. This particular knife that was stolen, I think in the 1600s or the 1700s, and it was stolen because it used to be used to perform surgery, where even staples were, you know, some metal staples were being used to suture the wound. So once you steal that object, it's not just an object where, oh, you know, the bronze was taken, the mask was taken, the knife and the spear were taken. These objects carry with them stories that we will possibly, if there, you know, because there's been a lot of resistance in returning these objects, we will never know or we will never recover. And for me, that becomes imperative, that it's not just the object, it's not just the person. It's the essence of the culture and the history that they carried with them that was stolen, that we don't have access to, and therefore we do not know. And therefore we become disconnected from who we actually are. Yeah.
And I'm thinking, where are most of these items in general, and who really is keeping them?
Right. We must think, when we think of colonialization, we must think of empire. It was going around conquering lands. And of course, now we had the Germans and the French, etc. When we think of these countries, we must think of them in terms of institutions, because it was not an individual waking up in the morning and saying, okay, let's just go on walkabout and conquer the nearest people we find. These were very organized institutions. Part of the institutions was the church and also the monarchies, whether we're talking about the British monarchy or any of these other institutions. So where are these objects? Some of the first place these objects are at are the museums. I'll give you an example of some of these museums. The British Museum is holding the Rosetta Stone. Mm-hmm. Now, the Rosetta Stone is a very significant piece of architecture because it was removed from a temple or a building in ancient Egypt. And on it were inscriptions that later were translated hieroglyphic as a sophisticated language, a sophisticated way of communication. Now, once the British stole this Rosetta Stone and they took it before they put it in the British Museum, they actually had the guts, you know, the chest to add their own inscription captured in Egypt by the... And I thought, wait a minute.
Really? So,
yes, you find this piece of ancient art that exists way... I think in the years before Christ. Exactly. So this one is sitting in the British Museum. You have the Nefertiti bust. The Nefertiti bust fascinated Adolf Hitler. And once it was in you know, it was part of his consciousness, he said, I will never part with her. This one is sitting in the News Museum in Berlin. So we have all these, Victoria and Albert Museum in the UK is holding the loot from Magdala, which I actually indicated earlier was the northern citadel of Emperor Theodros II. All these different museums, Pied Branly in Paris, France, all these museums are holding onto our objects. And because of this, after I think the Second World War and this dialogue between European countries and the US, some of these objects have found their way to many museums in the United States as well. So the first place we think about are the museums. The second we think about are the vaults. Vaults, like for example, would be in the universities, these old universities, because the origins of these universities are very religious. This is where the monks would run away from very temperamental monarchs in London and establish, you know, a monastery somewhere in the hinterlands. And this is actually how these ancient universities came into being. Jesus College in Cambridge, for example, is holding onto a bronze sculpture of a cockerel from Nigeria. And I think they handed it back a couple of years ago. The University of Aberdeen had a bronze head of a Nigerian Oba. They are returning or have returned. And this was among the objects looted from the ancient kingdom of Benin, which is one of my favorite stories ever. And I think I will tell it. Universities of Oxford and all this. So have their vaults. And some of these vaults have actually turned into museums, like the Pitt Rivers Museum at the University of Oxford has a lot of Maasai history and objects stored there. And there's an anecdote that was even told where some Maasai, I think, leaders were invited to the Pitt Rivers Museum. And when they came back and said, we went to this museum and we saw our objects, but they had the wrong names. Some of them had the wrong histories. Some of the spellings of the names were wrong. Those are the vaults. And then we have, for me, which is the most problematic, the private collections. Private collections are usually held by very wealthy people. They include art, and they also include some of these objects that were taken. Many of these millionaires and billionaires have a propensity to collect things which are rare because they know if I have the cockerel in my house and it was stolen from Benin in 1600s, I'm the only person in the world ideally who has it. So there is that propensity. I think it's a capitalistic propensity to have rare items. So, and the private collections are the most problematic because once something enters a private collection, we have no idea where it is. We have no idea where it's being stored. We have no idea, even when these so-called millionaires and billionaires decide to become philanthropic and hand over a section of their collection to a museum to be displayed, we have no idea if these are replicas that have been done and whether these are the originals. So for me, private collections are the most insidious because they could be anywhere. They could be anywhere in Europe. And we also know from anecdotal evidence, I was watching something on Netflix, a documentary called Made You Look, where all these billionaires are buying art as a form of tax evasion. Once we enter that, it becomes a very dark world where people are evading tax, where people are storing their collections at airports, because as long as it's at the airport, it cannot then be declared to have entered the country. So they've got these beautiful warehouses in various airports where they keep these objects under lock and key, etc. So we have those again. They're all over the world, the Americas as well. And some of them, I suspect, are actually on the continent as well. So,
but then now we are talking about the cultural violence built into, you know, colonial histories. What stories did we lose when this happens?
For me, the first port of call when you talk about cultural violence is the language of false discovery. You had all these people discovering things which already existed. And once you discover something, you name it. For example, when you're scaling Mount Kenya, I understand, I've only gone to the first base camp, Old Moses. But as you're scaling Mount Kenya, I understand there is a lake called Lake Ellis. We have Lake Victoria. We have Lake Albert. We have different places around our country, around our continent. Thompson's gazelles. I'm thinking we had names for these animals. With the language of false discovery, that's the first breach when it comes to cultural violence. Because if I start calling this animal a Thompson's gazelle, because Thompson discovered it. It means from there onwards, I will always be referring to this animal as a Thompson's gazelle.
Yeah.
And I will give you an example. There is this notorious, like I call him notorious because I feel he was notorious, an Oxford historian. His name is Hugh Trevor Roper. And he is on record as infamously saying, the history of Africa is the history of the white man in Africa. Beyond that is only darkness. And this is quote unquote. And then we had Joseph Conrad, for example, writing this very famous book, which we were forced to read as part of our syllabus in school, called The Heart of Darkness, where this narrative of this dark continent that had nothing, it only had things to discover. It had people to discover who were in
For that dark continent, we really filled up their museums, you know, so much for the dark continent. You know, that I don't even miss it totally.
Exactly. And so when you call it the dark continent, intellectually, that means there was nothing. It's like when, you know, when you read the biblical stories of creation, you know, there was just darkness, and then God said, let there be light. So the colonialist in that sense becomes God that says to this dark continent, this dark space, let there be light. And then the light becomes the European walking around naming. I mean, we had Adam in the Garden of Eden naming things. Same thing the Europeans were doing here, you know, naming animals, naming lakes. When I think like Victoria's true name from the Kenyan side was Namlolwe, I want to ask myself, what did that mean? What are the stories of Namlolwe? Why was it called Namlolwe? What are some of the legends that emanated from calling this lake Namlolwe? And it's violence because when we tell these stories, they are now relegated to myth. They're not true stories, even when these stories were true. So, for example, when I tell my students that in the ancient kingdom of Benin, in the 1400s, there were underground water cisterns. The wall, you know, that went around this ancient city was so huge and so long, they would rival that of the Great Wall of China. The violence for me is that once these stories are erased, because we renamed these places, all these were completely erased, carved out, arbitrary borders.
Interestingly, actually, since you made reference to it, I'll try to get it, and then I think we'll bring this up in part three.
Okay.
There's actually that conversation about how labor was shaped in East Africa and in West Africa. There's a study of that.
Yeah.
And just how what you're saying is spot on, that it's
yes. And and so for me, the idea of the fixed gender roles, because right now we have, and this is my view. When you log onto social media, there's a lot of animosity and antagonism against women who voice the idea that fixed gender roles are not really an African thing. It was not a woman must do A, B, C, D, and a man must do this. These are ideas that are ideas of capitalism. Capitalism was brought to our shores by white people who started to place, value, a value on someone. So the value of a man was, and again, we have, when we talk about these things, we have to go back into the class structure of British society. You had the royalty and, you know, the monarchy at the top. And then I think the second, you know, there were four estates. I think the first one was, you know, the king, and then you had the earls and all these other, you know, the people who served at the king's pleasure. And then you had the clergy. And then, of course, now in later, you know, in the modern, we said the fourth estate is the press. These first three were very fixed. So the value of somebody depended on where they fell within this strata. So if you are not lucky enough to be born the son of an earl, the son of a king, the son of a duke, essentially it meant you were relegated to, you know, the poor people, the people who had no value. You know, the masses, which is what now we call the masses. And we did not have that kind of fixed structure. Yes, we had royalty and all that, but our structures were a little bit more flattened. It was not that if you are not born the son of an owl, that's the end of your life. Yes, we had sons of chiefs and kings and all that. But these, the fixation of gender roles for me can be linked back also to class roles, because you've got now classed women and classed men sort of having these hierarchies that to me are very capitalistic. It depends on how much capital I have, whether it is economic capital or cultural capital. That if I sit here and I am so-and-so's somebody, or I know so-and-so, it means I have power over the next person next to them, you know, who does not know. So some of these things, I would argue, are actually, they did come to our shores and became very fixed. You know, they became very
part of the cultural violence.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah, so I'm thinking just two more points of concerns, and I think we can combine them. Where is the state of the Euro-American mind as regards this repatriation? You know, are they bringing back these things? Are they willing to bring back these things? What conversations are they trying to have with us and having amongst themselves as regards the things their people stole? But also number two, on our end, do we have, or are we foreseeing the possibility of beginning to have laws nationally, but also have laws at some of these transnational and international platforms of justice, where we begin to use legal frameworks to compel the return of what is essentially stolen property?
Very important question. So I'll start with the first one. The state of the Euro-American mind is one of reluctance. I'll give you an example. A few years ago, the government of Nigeria requested for some specific bronzes to be returned, and the British government said no. Then there was a ceremony, whether I don't know if it was 50 years of independence or something like that. So they went back and requested the British government to loan a specific bronze, which was going to be used as, you know, a centerpiece in this celebration. And the British government, the official position was, no, this thing is too fragile to travel. But the Nigerians were saying something different. They said that the British government had demanded a hefty insurance money, which was going into the millions of dollars, that they found to be extremely punitive and unnecessary. And so that example I'm giving is an example of the status of the Euro-American mind in returning some of the especially the big items. The Rosetta Stone at the British Museum is one of the most visited, so it's a huge income earner for the British Museum. And so you can see the reluctance is not just, it's not just about holding on to these objects because they form a part of the histories of empire, but also because of the financial implications. I've said something about the stories of empire. I keep feeling that part of the reluctance, especially for the UK, in returning some of these objects, especially, you know, the Rosetta Stone and these other huge ones, is because a large section of the history of empire has been one of looting. And so if I have formed my identity in the present world through taking people's objects, if I return these objects, if I'm compelled to return these objects, it means that my identity sort of becomes very shaky. It's on shaky ground. What do I base my existence as a global power on if I have to return all these things that define me, that I took from somewhere? So for me, that is also part of this reluctance to return these objects. Now, I have to say, some smaller museums, especially in America, have returned some of the objects. Some objects, either Bigango or some carvings that were used to mark the graves of the departed from a specific, I think that the Giriama, once they were covered in a museum and there was a demand for provenance, which is usually when you're asked either as a museum or an art gallery, how did you obtain this thing that you have? So the certificate of provenance shows, you know, the origin of this. This was painted by so-and-so. It was in his, you know, there has to be a traceable, you know, there has to be paperwork.
Yes.
So when demands for provenance came up for this particular, I think it was a museum in Chicago, and they found out that they were stolen, they were very willing to bring them back. Unfortunately, and this is anecdotal because I don't want to get in trouble, but unfortunately, the authority wanted some millions of shillings in for import duty.
Oh,
and the
okay.
museum said, we cannot, we are returning these things to you. You need to take them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the National Museum was slapped with that bill. They could not pay it. And I think they were taken back to the United States and either are currently sitting at an airport or somebody who knew somebody at the Ministry of Culture managed to bring them back. So we have stories like this as well, where it appears that we who are talking about repatriation are not on the same page with government structures that are in place. So if we want these objects to be returned and KRA is asking for an import permit and taxes, that becomes very problematic. So are there those at a transnational, and there was a 1970 UNESCO convention against the stealing or the stealing and dealing in antiquities and objects. I'll find the correct word, name of this convention. But once it was established, of course, there's no way of necessarily enforcing it.
Yeah.
And number two, many museums and art galleries and people with these collections interpreted this to mean that if you acquired something before 1970, you can keep it.
Statute of limitation.
Of course, it started in 1970 going forwards. Which was very problematic because, I mean, we have already gone through colonialism. You already have these objects in your midst. So, of course, it's also the way these laws are interpreted by these big countries with a lot of power that becomes very difficult to enforce. We cannot really force them to bring back these. The way in which to force them, to me, would be through different other avenues of pressure and not necessarily the laws. When they are the ones creating these laws, obviously it becomes very difficult.
Yeah, I mean, thank you for that. I would have asked for your parting shot, but I would say this is part one of the three-part series, and even for our listeners, this part one, we call it Bring Back the Stolen. Basically, what did we lose? We're trying to quantify through narratives, through numbers, through timelines, what we lost. But then next we'll be talking about lost in translation, and we'll go even way more anecdotal, and so we look forward to the next episode, Lost in Translation.
There's no parting shot. What I would say is that Jahazi Journal is surely not for sale. It's free. It's online. It's ours. And it's very accessible, even in terms of the language that has been used for many of these articles. So I would encourage our listeners to look at past issues of Jahazi. Look at this particular issue of Jahazi, because once these objects are returned, and this is going to be part of our next conversation, Where are they coming back to? And because we own this culture and we own this object in many ways, this becomes our conversation. And for me, I feel as Kenyan people, we are so detached from our history. I mean, if you do a Twitter poll today and ask people, was history a favorite subject? They'll say, no, history was boring. And, but people who don't know their history are people who are lost. And if we don't know who we are from where we came from, it's very difficult to chart a future, an Afro-future that centers us and our stories and our people. So I would encourage many of our listeners, do the research. The resources are online. The people are all over Twitter sharing all these things for free. Let's engage. Let's get interested in our history, because our histories reveal who we are. We discover we were very intelligent, we were very enterprising, we were very innovative.